Support for Ben Franklin's World and the Doing History to the Revolution series comes from the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture and HelloFresh.
Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to episode 152 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. What caused the American Revolution? Was it the issue of no taxation without representation? Was it conflict and change in the hierarchical social order of colonial and British society? Was it because the colonies had outgrown their status as British dependencies? Or was the revolution all about differences in ideas about governance and the roles government should play in society? Over time, historians have posited all of these ideas. In the books and articles that they've written about the revolution, they've used events, writings, and occurrences from before, during, and even after the revolution to make their case about what caused it. Now, there's no consensus about the origins of the American Revolution. Every historian has their own ideas about what caused it, just as they have their own ideas about how we should define the revolution, which you heard all about in episode 151. So, in this installment of our Doing History to the Revolution series, we're going to explore one set of ideas about the origins of the American Revolution, with a historian whose ideas about its causes has greatly contributed to historians' debates about it. 50 years ago, Bernard Bailyn, a professor emeritus of history at Harvard and a historian who's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, wrote an influential book about what caused the American Revolution. It's called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution. And since it first appeared in 1967, historians have been in some way or another responding to its ideas. So during our exploration of the ideological origins of the American Revolution, Professor Bailyn reveals how people understood the causes of the American Revolution prior to 1967, why he believes colonial Americans' ideas about governance and the powers governments should exercise caused the American Revolution, and the logic that drove Americans to rebel against and seek their independence from Great Britain. But first, just as a reminder, the Omohundro Institute has developed a lot of great bonus content for episodes in the Doing History to the Revolution series. It's all in the free OI Reader app. Now, I know I keep reminding you about the OI Reader app, but it's only because these resources are really great. Some of them are even interactive. So be sure to download the OI Reader so that you can enjoy and explore its offerings. Visit benfranklinsworld.com/OIReader or download the app for free in your favorite app store. Are you ready to explore the ideological origins of the American Revolution? Then let me introduce you to our guest historian. Joining us is the Adams University Professor Emeritus and the James Duncan Phillips Professor of Early American History Emeritus at Harvard University. He's the author of 14 books, including 2 that won the Pulitzer Prize, Voyagers to the West, A Passage in the Peopling of America on the Eve of the Revolution, and a book we'll discuss today, The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution. The Ideological Origins was first published in 1967 and is now available in a 50th anniversary edition. Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, Bernard Bailyn.
Thank you.
Professor Bailyn, we're really excited that you could join us and be a part of our Doing History to the Revolution series. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Published in 1967, The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution aimed to answer why the American Revolution took place and how Americans came by and developed their ideas about the constitutional and political struggle that they were witnessing. Professor Bailyn, would you tell us how people understood the American Revolution and its causes prior to the publication of your book?
Yeah, it depends how far back you want to go. You know, there have been histories of the Revolution from the time the Revolution happened. And they've been going on ever since. So many that I've grouped them in groups that seem to me to explain a lot about the attitudes of the historians. If I can take a minute on that, in the first group of histories written, they're still part of the war itself. They're still part of the revolution. And the writers are themselves either participants or connected to participants. And histories that are written at that stage are highly personified in heroes and villains and highly moral. There are good guys and bad guys. And that's an early phase that barely emerges from the revolution itself. Then if you look a couple of generations later, things have changed for historians because they can locate the events of the revolution in a long train of events. It's now locked into a longer story, and consequently, they're mainly interested in tracing antecedents, that is, the way in which things led up to the revolution and finally became part of it. It's a very different kind of history. And then in a third phase, which we're in now, really, I call a tragic phase because we know an enormous amount about the revolution. The documentation on the revolution is just stupendous, and it's still growing with new additions of individuals and of institutions. But we know an enormous amount, so much so that we can see the revolution in its full context as we never did before. And we can see the boundaries of it, the limits of what the people could do. And therefore, it does have a kind of tragic quality to it, not sad. It isn't a sad phase, but it does show the limits of their possibilities because we can certainly describe their circumstances in a way we never had before. And that's the stage we're at now, where we have this comprehensive knowledge of what happened. And the question is how you formulate it and what you emphasize and so forth. But it's all within boundaries that we can see that include not only those who won the revolution, but also those who lost it. And consequently, we speak now about the loyalists in ways that they've never been interesting before. In other words, we've come to a stage where we have to now digest this enormous amount of information and give some kind of coherent account of what happened in those terms.
What exactly prompted you to undertake research to find the ideological origins of the American Revolution? And why were you looking for the ideological origins and not, say, the economic or social origins that many scholars have claimed is what caused the revolution?
Well, I was never convinced that economic circumstances caused the revolution. There was no impoverished people. The free people, at least, in British North America, were among the most affluent in Western society. And there was no impulse that I saw at the start to recast the social order or to recast the economic order. And the situation was such that what struck me about it was to be able to get into the heads, into the minds of not everybody, but the minds of the people who led it and who left behind such enormous documentation of their thoughts. And the idea was to find out what complex of fears and hopes and recollections and notions of the past and guesses for the future, what they had in their heads that led them into the revolution, and to find this complicated event for them. So for me, it was not a matter of tracing the economic development. The economic development is important. It plays a role in various ways in the story. But the revolution was not an economic collapse or a calamity or a resolution, nor was there an attempt to recast the social order as, for example, the Russian Revolution did or the French Revolution did. The American Revolution was not undertaken to recast the social order. What's important about it is what the leaders of it had in mind, and that's really what the ideological origins is all about.
Now, we should talk about some of the documentation that Professor Balin mentioned earlier as being left behind from the period. In the original preface to The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, Professor Balin wrote that he came across more than 400 pamphlets written about the revolution during the revolution. Professor Balin, would you tell us about pamphlets and about the specific pamphlets you looked at? And why do you think that pamphlets hold the key to our understanding the American Revolution?
Yes, the pamphlets are not singular documents in the sense that they're the only things that matter, but they were convenient. A pamphlet is a small brochure, a small book with no cover, printed quickly, and it could vary in size from 10 to 200 pages. And the beauty of it and the usefulness of the pamphlets is that they contain everything under the sun. They contain sermons and lectures and personal correspondence and poetry and documents which themselves are too ephemeral ever to have been recorded. And they are, in other words, a printing vehicle for a miscellaneous cluster of expressions that make them so valuable. They are not exclusive documents to this. There are other documents of all kinds that play into it, but the pamphlets were particularly revealing because of the varied content, because of the number of them, and because of what we could take from them to understand rather subtle things about people's minds. And I used them heavily, as much as I could, because they were so useful. But they are supplementary to the general literature of the revolution, which, as I said before, is simply vast.
Do you happen to know how widely circulated and read the pamphlets of the revolution were?
That's a good question. You can't tell. That is, we can enumerate them. But how widely they were read, we can never say, because they circulated. They did cost a little amount of money. Not everybody got them. But when they were around, they were read, passed from hand to hand, as were newspapers. And so it's almost impossible to trace them in terms of circulation. That they were widely read, there's no doubt, because of the debates among them and because of all the references we know to them.
When exactly did presses begin publishing the pamphlets that you examined for the ideological origins of the American Revolution?
Well, almost from the beginning. I mean, the pamphlets are there before the revolution, and they're there after the revolution. I mean, it's a printing form, and the printers were very busy doing their newspapers, but also making these small pamphlet compilations, which held such a variety of material. You can't trace it in terms of actual circulation, nor can you trace the newspapers, even though we have a very detailed knowledge of what newspapers were printed. But how many read them, how they circulated, we can't tell.
Many historians date the start of the American Revolution to after the French and Indian War in 1763. And I wonder, do the pamphlets reveal how Americans viewed their place within the British Empire and really within the world at the end of the French and Indian War?
That is a very interesting question. After 1763 and until 1776, British North America was tied into the Atlantic networks of trade deeply. They were part of the trade to Africa, to the Caribbean, to South America, and especially, of course, to the trade routes to Britain. North America was Britain's greatest market for their goods. And the North American merchants were deeply involved in trade and exchange of goods with Britain. They were feeling very strong, and they were strong in a demographic sense to an astonishing degree. The population was rising rapidly. I would guess the population grew by something like 300,000-400,000 from 1763 to get up to the numbers in 1774. And we know a great deal about this migration that accounts for this huge demographic surge, because in December 1773, the British government became so concerned about the exodus of workers from Scotland and Britain itself that they established a register of emigrants. This is December 1773. That register was in place and active for 13 months. And we have the record of every person who left Britain, that is to say Scotland, Wales, and Britain itself, during those months, and vacating tenancies in Scotland to the extent that it was called the America Madness because of the migration to America. And we find that 10,000 people are in it who went to British North America. They went elsewhere as well, but just isolating British North America. And we have studied them, and I wrote a book about this called Voyagers to the West. It's a study of those 10,000 people. And you can see in this the way the American population was a boom population in this period, becoming stronger and stronger demographically and opening up territories for further growth and settlement of new people coming in that had never been opened before. The cost of that for the native Indians is, of course, a great story in itself. But nevertheless, the leaders of the revolution were aware of their own power in this sense, an economic sense, in context with the whole Atlantic world and in their demographic growth, which nobody would have predicted. So your question about their status and self-regard after 1763 seems to me an excellent question and has a great deal to do with what happened in the revolution.
What about the role of the Enlightenment in the revolution? As you know, many scholars think that the Enlightenment played a large role in helping British Americans develop their ideas about government and the role that government should play in society. What did you find in your research of all those pamphlets? Did the Enlightenment play a large role in shaping the ideology of the American Revolution?
Yes, you mean the Enlightenment ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, the Americans were well acquainted with the literature of the French Enlightenment and of the Enlightenment in Britain and Scotland. They knew all the writers. They knew Locke. They knew Voltaire. They knew Rousseau. They knew Beccaria. And above all, they knew Montesquieu. And his Spirit of the Laws book was everywhere in the libraries of North America. But these systematic ideas of the Enlightenment were not the ideas that shaped their actions or their deepest thoughts. Their deepest thoughts came not for that, although they digested those books, they knew them well, but they were more persuaded and their minds were shaped by the local tradition of British opposition political literature than by any of the writings of Rousseau or Voltaire. Though, as I say, they knew about them, but their minds intellectually were aware of that, but they were not shaped by it in the way they were by the traditions of British political thought that goes back really to the 17th century.
Would you tell us more about this British oppositional literature that seemed to do so much to shape Americans' thoughts and actions?
The 17th century in Britain was a time of great upheaval. As you know, there was a civil war. There were three civil wars, in fact, but they add up to one. And in the 1640s, all sorts of ideas were churning for reform, for transformation. There were upheaval ideas that had their say during that period. But then after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, those ideas went underground, so to speak, until the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And then the core of those earlier ideas took the shape of the Glorious Revolution, in which the British established parliamentary supremacy, abolished the possibility of a Catholic dictatorship threatened, they thought, by James II, and set up the terms of a regular electorate and regular meetings of Parliament and all the rest, which in the Bill of Rights and other documents were transferred into the early 18th century in the form of opposition literature to the reign of Robert Walpole, who was prime minister from the 20s to the 40s. That opposition literature, which absorbed so much of the 17th century background, was what the Americans fed on. It was exactly what they were looking for. And the vast publications of that period of opposition, drawn from the 17th century, which had become the so-called country party documentation of those who opposed the Walpole regime, was directly in line with what the Americans felt they were experiencing. And it was that that was deepest in their minds, as opposed to the systematic treatises of someone like Locke or Rousseau, which they knew, as I say, but did not determine their minds so much as that more local, so to speak, parochial British tradition of resistance to authority, which they drew from this literature whose origins goes back to the mid-17th century.
What ideas were in this English literature about resisting government? We know that governments need power to govern, so what powers did Americans think that the government should have in the 1760s and 1770s?
Well, the question of power, which I've written about at length, obsessed them. They wrote more about power and its evils than any other single topic. It meant to them dominance. It meant to them the end of freedom. Power was a malevolent force which they could discuss in the abstract and in the concrete. They knew concrete power in the form of British armies, of British officials, of taxation without representation, and all the rest of it was a system of power which they thought would drive out all liberty. And power to them, I can't stated fully enough, and I wrote about it at length, was their central concern all the way through the revolutionary period. And as I say, they were really obsessed with the fear of it because they believed that the exertion of autocratic power would be the end of their private liberties. And it's in those terms that they wrote about it, and it runs all the way through from 1760 to 1790. It's the key idea that dominated their thought.
So in what ways did 18th century Americans think that the British government was becoming more autocratic or absolute?
You see, from history, they drew lessons. They were concerned, and they knew a great deal about the ways in which free states become, because of autocratic power, become dominantly dictatorships. They were aware of this in historical examples about which they were eloquent, and they knew specifics about how free states had disappeared into autocracies. Their key example was Denmark, because of the ambassador to Denmark publication in 1693 of what had happened in that country. He cataloged moment by moment the process by which a free Denmark had become an autocratic state. They had all these signals. They had a system in their minds of those signals that indicate some kind of movement in that direction is taking place. And they could see it being duplicated in their own case as things moved from the Stamp Act crisis on to the other parts of the pre-revolution. And it was for them the controlling concept that they feared at all times. And to anticipate a question, perhaps, I might mention this. It was easy for them in the early years of the revolution to speak about resistance to power because they said they could identify what was happening and they resisted it. But in 1787-88, they had a different kind of problem. They were creating their own power center, despite the fact that they had just fought a war to get rid of one. And the great issue of the ratification controversy, which went on for 11 months, it's one of the greatest debates on political philosophy that's ever been recorded. The ratification debate was exactly this, namely, how can you create a power center at the same time retain the liberties of the people? It didn't exist, but they did it. And the result was the American Constitution. But if you examine the ratification process, which again is so voluminously documented, you find that they're grappling with power and trying to find, and they did find, devices of all kinds of arrangements of government organization and so forth by which you could exert a sufficient power without destroying popular liberties. But there were always people who distrusted this and said that it was not possible that in the end, America would turn into an autocracy under this regime and there would be not sufficient liberties. And the result of that concern, of course, is the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights were amendments that were written in the first Congress, and the acceptance of the Constitution by Massachusetts first and then other states was with the assumption that such a Bill of Rights would be created in the first Congress. And it was. It was proposed in the first Congress, devised by Madison, who himself had been one of the architects of the Constitution. And in the end, the result is a Bill of Powers in the Constitution and a Bill of Rights that followed. And that balance has created the American constitutional system.
You noted that after the American Revolution, the Americans implemented ideas that would hopefully check the autocratic or absolute power that they saw taking hold in Great Britain from creeping into their own governments. And after we take a moment to talk about our sponsor, I'd really like for us to explore whether the American revolutionaries ever proposed ideas for how the British government could check the power they feared before they declared their own independence. This episode of Ben Franklin's World is brought to you by HelloFresh. And I'm wicked excited about HelloFresh sponsoring this episode because I've actually been a happy HelloFresh customer for over a year. I love to cook, and HelloFresh helps me enjoy this time of the day even more because this meal kit delivery service takes all the stress out of menu planning and cooking. Each week, HelloFresh sends me a well-insulated, fully recyclable box full of food right to my front door. And each box contains easy-to-follow recipe cards, clearly labeled meal bags with all the ingredients I'll need to cook that meal, and cold, well-packaged meats. And all this food fits neatly into my refrigerator until I'm ready to cook it. And when I am ready to cook, I flip through the weekly recipe cards to see what my options are. So tonight, for example, I could cook steak and nectarine salad with arugula, pecans, and feta cheese, one-pan hearty pork chili with kidney beans and poblano pepper, or mushroom gravy chicken over couscous with lemony arugula. As with most HelloFresh recipes, any of these recipes will take me about 30 minutes to cook. And when I'm done cooking, I won't have to worry about over-serving Tim and I any food or any food waste, because HelloFresh has already measured and sent exactly the right amount of food for the two of us. And HelloFresh does all of this for me for less than $10 a meal. You should give HelloFresh a try and see how much more fun and easy they'll make your meal times. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and use promo code BFWorld30. So we were discussing colonial Americans' obsession with power and their fear that the British government was exercising more absolute power by the 1760s and 1770s. And it was the Americans' obsession and fear that absolute power would dominate and curtail their personal liberties that prompted them to create checks and balances within their own government when they wrote the Constitution of 1787 and the Bill of Rights in 1789. Professor Balin, before they declared independence, did American revolutionaries ever propose ideas for how the British government could check the increasing power it was exercising?
Yes, of course they did. From the Stamp Act on, they groped for ways of doing this, and they discovered that the tradition in their legal world made it impossible. They fought at one point in having coordinate power centers in the colonies and at home. They thought of various devices that we would think of as dominion status, which would be an independent country under the king. And the Declaration of Independence, one notes, has all these accusations not against Parliament, which they had given up on, but against the king. They're all accusations against the king because in the end, the king did not defend them, did not agree to what we would call dominion status. But they did think, they groped, they thought again and again in different ways to maintain the empire and be independent. And in the end, they lost it. That is, they couldn't do it. It was impossible to make such an arrangement. One of the long-term consequences on this is that the Irish Revolution at the end of the 18th century also had resistance to Parliament and also went through a challenging period. And in that case, in fact, the British government did concede to their proposals, but there was a revolution anyway.
Now, in the ideological origins of the American Revolution, Professor Balin has an entire chapter called The Logic of Rebellion, where he explains how Americans brought themselves to revolution. Professor Balin, would you tell us about the Americans' logic of rebellion?
Yes. As I said before, they had these signals of what the growth of an autocratic society was. And their experiences in the period from 1760 to 1775, when the fighting broke out, their experiences were to note the development of precisely those movements on the part of the British government consistent with the growth of an autocratic power. Of course, the British denied that they were doing anything of the kind. They were just trying to create a coherent empire, they were saying. But the Americans saw in this, because of what they knew of history, because of the way they had systematized this kind of thinking, they saw in it the stages of development of an autocratic system. But since the British were denying it, they were hiding it. And therefore, it was conspiratorial in the sense that it was happening, but it was not being professed. They were not saying what they were doing, why they were doing it, but they were doing it. And so they were doing it secretly. And this led them to convictions that a conspiracy on the part of the British government was developing. And that took hold of their minds. And I wrote in the book a whole section on the way in which this sense of a conspiracy developed. They were not paranoids. I mean, there's nothing psychologically wrong with these people. They were being very rational. But they themselves believed that the signs of autocracy were there, being hidden. It was a conspiracy at work.
Could we look at an example or two of the signals that told Americans that an autocratic system of government was taking hold in Great Britain? Specifically, in the ideological origins, you explore the Stamp Act, the Anglican bishop controversy, and the fact that Americans, unlike Britons, weren't allowed to appoint judges to lifetime terms. So would you take us through one of these examples and help us see where Americans saw a conspiracy afoot?
Well, as you know, the rumor of an Anglican bishop in America was enough to scare the wits out of them because of what its effect would be on the practice of religion. But there were developments initially, of course, of taxation, which they wouldn't accept because they had no role in it, despite the fact that most people in Britain never had a role in their own taxation. But they saw evil in that. They saw evil in the reorganization of government with more officials being sent to police trade, to keep the restrictions on trade, which had been very loose, to tighten them up, to bring in a higher income. And they experienced in certain places the lack of an independent judiciary, since, as in the case of Massachusetts, judges who long had been paid, hence in their minds controlled, by the local assemblies were now being paid by Britain directly from the income that was made from customs in America. And that was a blatant sign of a growing disorder to their disadvantage. And there were others that had to do with trade, as the British government after 1763 tried to create a controlled and profitable colonial empire.
So it really sounds like this conspiracy had a lot to do with Great Britain's imperial government removing power and control from local colonial governments.
That's correct. That's exactly what they thought. And all of these little signals were just the signs that they feared that the government in Britain itself was moving in this wrong direction. And to anticipate a question, the converse was true. That is, the officials and people like Hutchinson, the last royal governor of Massachusetts, whom I wrote about in another book, were convinced that the colonial resistance was not a coherent and rational move that they could understand. Behind it, they were convinced, lay the desire to break with Britain and to create their own independence, even though people denied that that's what they were doing. But the British government and people like Hutchinson believed that that's exactly what they were doing, but they weren't saying it. And consequently, they developed the belief that it was, on the part of people like Sam Adams, a conspiracy also of their hiding their intention. In fact, most people did not have that intention, but it could be construed that way in the resistance movement. And consequently, there are these convergent notions of conspiracies at work, which made reconciliation extremely difficult. And as I say, I've written about that separately in the Hutchinson biography, but it comes out in so many different ways.
Since you've brought it up, I wonder if we could talk about the Hutchinson biography. In the preface to your book, The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchinson, you note that we can't understand the ideology, meaning the beliefs, fears, attitudes, and perceptions of the American Revolution, until we understand the views of the other side. That in order for us to really understand the ideology of the American Revolution, we must try to make sense of what any sensible, well-informed, right-minded American with a modicum of imagination and common sense could have possibly opposed the revolution. So, Professor Balin, I wonder if you would provide us with an overview of the views of the other side and why men like Thomas Hutchinson opposed the American Revolution.
Yeah, well, I wrote the Hutchinson biography precisely for that purpose, to show the other side and to show it in the history, in the biography of a very intelligent, very well-informed, very rational man. Hutchinson was the best historian that British North America ever produced. And he was a man of goodwill, very intelligent, and very well informed. But what comes out of the biography and is so valuable for the story as a whole is that he had no way of responding to the passions that were closing the minds of the resistance. He couldn't bend to it. They weren't rational. They weren't traditional. If you're traditional, if you're rational, you don't do things that the Adamses were doing. You don't resist in that way because there has to be a power center somewhere. And in that relationship, the colonies would be deficient. They would be the losers. And from his point of view, they were not being rational. There is a wonderful collection of materials called the Briefs on the Revolution, put together by a law professor, John Reed, which gathers together the debate, or debates, I should say, between Hutchinson and the Massachusetts Assembly in 1773. It was an extended debate on all of these issues that we're talking about, and very rational, very cogent, and very subtle in many ways. And what comes out of it is that, to see it from Hutchinson's side, these people are being unreasonable. They're not taking into account what all of history has shown, that you have to have established institutions that they were resisting and so forth. And on the assembly side, laying out the reasons for a resistance that had no predecessor. There was no precedent for them. And that's what Hutchinson and the Loyalists couldn't understand or couldn't respond to, especially Hutchinson. And that's why he is such an extremely important and indeed tragic figure, because for all of his ability, he was defeated totally and ended up in pathetic exile in England. Even though his public service had been so large and so useful, even so his learning had been so extensive, and even so his reasoning was so keen, for all of that he lost. And if you say, why did he lose? It's because he had no way of responding to the surges in the population, in the popular attitudes that were dominating the resistance movement. There's no way he could incorporate that. He didn't have the flexibility of mind. He was a responsible, established person, and he had no flexibility to respond to forces that were new to him and that he thought were threatening.
Thomas Hutchinson, indeed, was an important person. And for those of us who are unfamiliar with him, would you provide us with a brief overview of who Thomas Hutchinson was and what he accomplished in his life?
Oh, that's a big story. Well, as I say, he was very intelligent. He was of the Hutchinson family, which went back to Anne Hutchinson in the 17th century. They were the most established family in the Boston area, and they had been successful merchants. They were rich relative to the population, and they were eager for public office, too eager for public office in his case. He was himself kind of a Puritan. He was austere and very abstemious in his tastes, but he was very well educated. He was even erudite, and he was a clear thinker and a clear writer. But the problem was he was limited in his sensibilities. He couldn't respond to these new forces that were at work. I found him, for all of his stiffness and kind of lack of imagination, I found him a rather sympathetic character, despite the fact that people like John Adams and Mercy Otis Warren and the rest of the Massachusetts crowd thought he was the villain of all villains. But he lost badly because of the circumstance he was in. In 1770, he wrote what I think are pathetic letters back to the administration in London, saying he didn't want to be governor, that he couldn't cope with it. And the letters crossed, and he received his commission before they had read his letters. But in 1770, he did become the royal governor, despite his fear of the role and what he knew lay ahead. So I found him sympathetic. He ended up in terrible circumstances in England, though he met the king and was celebrated by certain people, certain of the nobility. He fell into very bad shape, and his family died off there in London under the worst circumstances.
I understand you wrote your biography of Thomas Hutchinson using some correspondence that was acquired in a rather unique way. And I wonder if you would tell us about the documentation that you used to write The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchinson.
The poor man, he had a house in what I think is now Dedham, in a suburb of Boston. He loved it. It was a small house. We have pictures of it. And he loved it beyond any habitation he had seen anywhere in the world. And he wanted nothing better to get back there for his leisure. Unfortunately, when he left in 1774 in a hurry to England, he cemented into the wall of the house his massive correspondence, and it contained everything he had written and all of the documentation of his official role. It was all sealed up, plastered into the wall. Unfortunately, in 1775, they broke the wall open, that is the revolutionaries, and they had before them the whole of his official and private correspondence. And while he was in England, he discovered that little by little, they were publishing all of his private papers. And they came out in the newspapers in America as evidence of the horror that he had created. And they were reprinted in England as well. And that huge collection of his correspondence, now being published in a very elegant form for the first time, volume one has just been published, that huge documentation broke his heart as he tried somehow to cope with his circumstances.
Professor Balin, why do you think men like Thomas Hutchinson were okay with Great Britain removing powers that colonial governments used to exercise to London, while men like John and Samuel Adams were not okay with it?
Well, on his part, it's easy to say, and I've just said it, namely, he had no way to flexibly respond to these surges that were taking place of popular distrust of government and defiance of it. On the part of the radicals, they were trying to keep from being dominated. They wanted to retain their own independence, which had been the case before 1763. And for this, they reached beyond established institutions and laws to deeper elements like natural law, especially natural law, and human rights, which transcend ordinary legislation. And with that, they built up a resistance movement outside of the boundaries of established laws and institutions, because that was the only way to assure themselves of freedom from the dominance that they resisted and which they felt would be the end of their liberties.
Before we conclude, would you tell us what aspects of current scholarship on the American Revolution you find most appealing?
That's hard to say. A lot's coming out. Lots is being written, and I'm trying to keep up with it. At the moment, I'm still working on aspects of these ideas and constitutional relations that I worked on before to put them in certain different forms. So at the moment, there's no new device, that thing that's going on that particularly attracts me. But there is much interesting new material, and God knows what will turn up next. A lot of historians do a lot of history on that subject in this country, and we will get new accounts for sure as these new generations of historians come on the scene.
And where is the best place to look for more information about you, your work, and how we can contact you if we have questions about the ideological origins of the American Revolution?
Well, anybody can get in touch with me through email. It's just balin@fas.harvard.edu. And otherwise, I don't know, I suppose Wikipedia or Google or so has some kind of approach to what I've been working at. I don't have anything like that in writing.
Bernard Balin, we've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us for the Doing History to the Revolution series and for helping us better understand the ideological origins of the American Revolution.
Well, you're welcome. I hope it came through usefully enough.
The ideological origins of the American Revolution is about what the leaders of the revolution had in mind about government, the powers it should exercise, and who should exercise those powers. To find answers to these questions, to find what the revolution's leaders were really thinking, Professor Balin looked at more than 400 pamphlets, small brochures that varied in size from 10 to 200 pages and contained a variety of ideas. Now, pamphlets are really supplements to the general literature of the revolution, but they also highlight the revolutionaries' more subtle ideas about how they thought about government, power, and imperial society. And when combined with the general literature of the revolution, pamphlets allowed Professor Balin to access the minds of the revolutionaries. And what these pamphlets revealed is that it was the ideas of the English Revolution and civil wars of the 1640s, and of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, more than the ideas of the French and European Enlightenments, that shaped revolutionary Americans' actions and deepest thoughts. In particular, Americans became consumed with thoughts about power. Because if a government exercised too much power, it meant that it would dominate the populace that it governed and curtail or even end that populace's private liberties. And Americans knew that a government could grow too powerful because they reference history, especially the history of the rise of autocratic power in Denmark. And since they knew their history, early Americans knew that they needed to watch for signs that their government was expanding and consolidating greater power. Signs like the imposition of the Stamp Act, the creation of an American bishopric, and the insistence that the British government, not local colonial governments, should pay the salary of American judges. Now, to men like Thomas Hutchinson, these warning signals didn't make any sense. He and other imperial officials denied that the British government was exercising more power and claiming power formally exercised by the colonies. But to men like Samuel and John Adams, the British government was usurping colonial power and threatening to squash their liberties. Now, according to the ideological origins of the American Revolution, it was ideas about power and governance that fed the logic of colonial rebellion against Great Britain and caused the American Revolution. Look for more information about Professor Balin, his books, plus notes and links for what we talked about today on the show notes page, benfranklinsworld.com/152. Thank you to both the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture and HelloFresh for making today's episode possible. Remember, for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and use promo code BFWorld30. And thank you also to the Doing History team at the Omohundro Institute for your assistance with this episode. I'm really grateful you helped arrange the interview with Professor Balin and for all the bonus materials you came up with for the OI Reader app. Finally, what do you think caused the American Revolution? Do you think the revolution was caused by ideology, economic or social factors, or something else? Let me know. Send your answers to liz@benfranklinsworld.com, tweet me @LizCovart, or post a comment in our listener community on Facebook.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.